Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we'll be talking with nurse, community health educator, and activist Elena Schwalski about her new book, Waking in Havana, a memoir of AIDS and healing in Cuba. First, however, we got some research that matters. The very first one is really about gun violence. We're going to be doing some more shows on this topic as we move forward and try to bring some interesting perspectives on this that maybe we haven't covered before. One of them that I think we're just talking about our research that matters is survey data. What's the role of survey data? You know, when we say, what do people feel? What do people believe? Well, we typically think in a democracy that, you know, when you have the majority of people believing something, we enact policies that move in that direction, presuming that those policies aren't discriminatory. So we wouldn't move towards a policy that took away healthy people's ability to make decisions. But when we're balancing decision-making, like ownership of guns and certain types of weapons, against public health issues of suicides and homicides that are preventable, we oftentimes look at these things. And it turns out in public surveys of Americans and Democrats and Republicans, overwhelming majorities do favor some common sense gun control legislation. And these are not the kind of major ones that, you know, people think and say, well, it's about taking away pistols or taking away revolvers, even taking away shotguns. These are things like gun magazines holding more than 10 rounds of ammunition. Military-style assault weapons, for which there was a ban and it expired, but again, supported overwhelmingly by the majority of Americans. Background checks and broadening there so that you can ensure that guns aren't in the hands of those who are more likely to have violence or more likely to be warning flags or have committed crimes that would suggest that. These polls do show two-thirds of women are worried about mass shootings, but only half of men are worried about mass shootings. Mass shootings are indiscriminate in really who they kill. And women are more likely to believe that passing these laws would reduce mass shootings. So the real question for me and to think about is, well, what does it take? What is it going to take? What does it take policymakers to follow the public? We do know that this is a political issue, but it would appear to this family physician, this public health advocate, that when the American public really does believe in something, that we need to find out what's it going to take to get us there to what I would call common sense measures that don't infringe on people's rights. We don't think people have a right to, for instance, probably have, you know, grenades and machine guns, bazookas. So we already have these limitations. What are the other common sense things that we can agree on and really make some progress here to reduce mass shootings? They will continue if we don't make some changes. Our next research that matters really looks at the vaping associated injuries, thousands now across the United States, and lung diseases and deaths that have occurred. But this was an article from the Mayo Clinic and in the New England Journal of Medicine that really looked at 13 men and 4 women who had a history of vaping. Now, many of these people had vaped both electronic cigarettes and marijuana or cannabis oils. What increasingly the research shows is that there was lung damage, and in this report, it resembled chemical burns. It does suggest that given the extent of these injuries, that far more research is needed, far more regulation is needed of the vaping industry expansively, because as we're legalizing medical marijuana, you still have this bootleg and you have these contaminants. And then within the electronic cigarette industry, because of the explosion of youth using these, but looking at not just the oils, but also the chemical compounds, the chemical constituents, and certainly flavors. We understand that, at least with electronic cigarettes, there's really concern about the sorts of impacts on lung tissue that is worrisome in terms of inflammation. So I think the opportunity of what's happening nationally stimulates hopefully more research, hopefully more attention, and hopefully makes products safer for everyone. Next and last research that matters has to do with pregnancy and vaccinations. And I just want to say that there are vaccinations that all pregnant women are supposed to get, and it's influenza and this Tdap, this pertussis booster with that Tdap vaccination. And it turns out in research studies most recently that only 55% of pregnant women received this Tdap vaccination during their pregnancy and 54% have received a flu shot. This hasn't really changed over time, given the fact that flu season continues to be a major killer, that children can't get it till they're 6 months of age, get a flu vaccination so there's any protection, and that we have children that die from influenza. They 20 may die of pertussis, 20 babies a year in the United States. These are preventable illnesses for the most part. So really encouraging doctors and pregnant patients, doctors who care for pregnant patients, have the conversations, family members of pregnant people, to have those conversations, to request from your physicians these Tdap and influenza vaccinations during pregnancy. Only 75% of pregnant women say they've actually even had that recommendation from their doctors to get the two vaccinations.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with nurse, community health educator, and activist Elena Schwalski about her new book and experiences, Waking in Havana, a memoir of AIDS and healing in Cuba. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with nurse, community health educator, and activist Elena Schwalski about her new book, Waking in Havana, A Memory of AIDS and Healing in Cuba. Welcome to Your Health, Elena.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, this is a really fascinating journey, a fascinating book, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'd like to know a little bit about you, though. I know that you became a nurse and a community health educator and an activist. How did your interest in health professions start? Where did that come from?
Well, I think, you know, it started rather late in my life compared to a lot of people that I know. I became a nurse at the age of 28, I guess. I had two small children. I was initially interested in becoming a midwife because I had had some experience coaching women through childbirth and had my own experiences. So I started in nursing thinking that I was going on that path. But along the way, pediatric nursing really captured my heart, and I loved working with families in many of the different settings I worked, kind of in a long-term way. Many of the kids that I worked with had chronic illnesses, and so I really came to know them and be involved with their families over a long period of time. And I loved that about my work.
And so what about the community health educator, the public health, and then the advocacy? Because those things, it seems like one could lead to the other.
Yeah, one did lead to the other, and it was kind of at a turning point in both my life and my career, when I had worked as a pediatric AIDS nurse for almost a decade, and I was just really feeling just wrung out and exhausted from the intense emotions and energy of that work. And I truthfully wanted to be more on the prevention end of the healthcare spectrum for the rest of my career, and so I actually went back to school and got a master's in public health with a focus on community health education. And that's where that work began. And that led me to work that I currently do, even though I'm somewhat retired, which is training frontline community health workers who serve right at the point of community efforts to educate around health.
So we're talking with Elena Schwalski, a community health educator, nurse, activist, about her new book, Waking in Havana, a memoir of AIDS and healing in Cuba. Take us back to going to Cuba, interest in what was happening there and how your intersection of the three worlds of healthcare and public health and advocacy came together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, actually, my first trip to Cuba was in 1972. I believe I was 24 at the time. I had one child, my son, who was two, and I had been an activist since the days of the civil rights movement, kind of caught my passion when I was still in high school. The Vietnam War came along, and I joined the movement against to end that war. And I was embroiled in that, had not yet become a nurse, and I was invited, recruited to go along on a trip of young Americans who were traveling to Cuba to sort of see what the Cuban Revolution was all about and also to actually do physical labor to support the Cuban people in their effort to build a new country after the revolution. And I said yes. And part of it was I was very, very interested in what it would be like to be in a country that was reinventing itself in that way. And part of it, I have to admit, was adventure. And, you know, going to Cuba was illegal at that time. And, you know, we had to travel through Mexico and the FBI took our pictures and it was a bit of an ordeal, but being there just re-energized me in ways that I hadn't experienced and really needed at that time. I had just come through a painful divorce. So that was my very first trip, and I didn't go back for 20 years after that because life intervened, and, you know, I was raising my family and starting my career and always interested, though, always keeping my interest alive in what was going on.
And, of course, you were reinventing yourself at the same time that others and countries are reinventing themselves. And I think the AIDS...
Exactly.
The AIDS epidemic for so many people around the world has caused you and us and myself to reinvent ourselves and how we think about care and public health and advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, that was definitely true. I started seeing my first pediatric AIDS patients as a visiting nurse in Washington Heights in New York City in the early to mid-80s when it wasn't even fully accepted that children could have AIDS. And those pediatricians who were saying, wait a minute, this looks like something that we're seeing in other ways, looks like the same disease, and they were being kind of ridiculed or, you know, told that that couldn't be true. And then AIDS came home to my own family when my husband was diagnosed in 1988. By that time, I had moved into working at a pediatric AIDS clinic in Newark, New Jersey. So I was working full time in the epidemic, and the, you know, coming together of those two streams was just, you know, a very powerful moment in my life. And in many ways, I think it enhanced my work because it enabled me to understand in a very palpable way what the families I was working with were actually going through. But it also created a lot of challenges in trying to be a caregiver, a personal caregiver, and then having this professional, you know, kind of side of my work. And sometimes I felt almost like I was drowning in the epidemic, like, you know, there was no respite.
I know in those, at that time, there weren't a lot of good medications, really almost no medications at that time. And I had a brother-in-law who had HIV and ultimately died. And I know how difficult it is when you really, other than caring for people, there's not a whole lot else. So it had to have been just so difficult because you're dealing with it personally, professionally, as you said, kind of no escaping.
Yeah, no, it was very hard at that time. In the clinic, we had very little to offer kids because everything has to go through adult testing and safety before, you know, it can be tried in kids. So there was very little available. And for my husband, you know, he did get better for a while after his first really devastating illness where he got his diagnosis. But then those medications kind of ran out of their efficacy and there was nothing more coming around the bend at that point. So there was a lot of, there was a time in the clinic, I think we must have gone to a funeral a week of a small child. And every time we did, I remember wondering to myself, you know, is it going to be my turn next to be grieving? And that was just, even as I talk about it now, I think sometimes I forget how wrenching that was at that moment.
Yeah, well, and I know it's not easy to share, even though you've written a book that takes us on a journey together. And we're going to need to take a short break, but I do want to come back and I want to have you take us through the return that you did and the waking back in Havana and your book and the experiences. Because I think it is a really powerful and motivating of taking some of the grief and difficulty and turning it into a journey that has lots of healing and lots of things for lots of us. So we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Elena Schwalski about her new book, Waking in Havana. We'll be right back with Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with nurse, community health educator, and activist Elena Schwalski about her new book, Waking in Havana, a memoir of AIDS and healing in Cuba. And right before the break, we spent a powerful few minutes, Elena, hearing about your work and caring for people that were vulnerable and caring for your husband, who was also vulnerable and ultimately succumbed to HIV. And your initial experiences in Cuba, but then you returned to Cuba and really did some amazing things, which I think led to this book. Tell us about the return and how you started to get involved.
The return came about just 6 months after my husband had died. I received an invitation to go on a public health delegation to Cuba. And as I mentioned before, I hadn't been back in all those years. But it was a place I remembered with great affection and warmth and had always wanted to go back. I thought, again, this would be an opportunity to kind of jumpstart this next phase of my life and reinvent myself in a way. And so I took that opportunity. And during that trip, which was a short trip, I had an opportunity to visit one of Cuba's AIDS sanatoriums. Cuba had taken a very different approach to containing the HIV epidemic when it first came to its shores in around 1985 by quarantining people who tested positive for the virus in residential communities across the island. They felt that their resources would be totally unequal to the ability to care for people if a widespread epidemic ensued. And until they got a handle on how to prevent that, they took these measures. And that was very different from anything that had been done elsewhere in the world. And so I really wanted to get a sense of what that looked like on the ground. And I had an opportunity to visit an AIDS sanatorium. And through that, the connections I made there, I had the chance to go back in 1996 and live in Cuba for 6 months and work at the AIDS sanatorium doing similar work to what I was doing at that time in the U.S., which was training frontline community health workers. In this case, they were peer educators, people living with the virus who were going to begin education in their communities. And in that experience, I just formed, you know, lifelong friendships and bonds and learned so much about a society so different from our own, but one where actually there is universal health care and it's free and it's guaranteed to everyone. So although there are material resource shortages, you know, there's no shortage of care and compassion and in Cuba. And that's what I saw and learned so much from while I was there.
So when I think back, Elena, to some of my own experiences, and I was in the former Soviet Union as it was opening up and doing healthcare missions and confronting people with AIDS there who, and this stigma with AIDS, but also a society that didn't have the resources to care for people with AIDS, didn't have the medications there. The medications were empty, and so the difficulties. Tell us the experiences that you had. Give us some examples of some of the sorts of things that you encountered, and how did you deal with those?
Well, by concentrating the resources in these residential communities, I think Cuba was able for a period of time to really sort of keep up with the epidemic and keep it in check. I will say that, yes, there are shortages of medications and empty shelves, and there were at that time in Cuba. Unfortunately, our country has maintained a trade embargo against Cuba, which also includes medications and humanitarian resources. And so Cuba had to go far afield to purchase AIDS medications, like to India, and have them shipped from India, which greatly added to the cost. Eventually, they were able to create their own, in their own laboratories, they were able to create some of the AIDS medications themselves. So there were always those challenges. What I did see, though, and there was stigma initially, there was certainly fear and stigma in the general population. And it was, you know, in many ways similar to here, where the initial diagnosis in those early years was treated like a death sentence. Those things all we had in common. What happened, though, that I saw that was different from my families in Newark, who were struggling in very isolated in their communities, sometimes traveling halfway across the state to buy their medication so no one would find out. What I saw there was a lot of support that was readily available to people living with HIV and AIDS at that time, both from their peers, from other people who were infected and affected, and from professionals, from doctors and nurses who had chosen to work with this population. Eventually, those barriers came down of the quarantine, and there was a lot of education done to prepare the population to receive people with HIV with compassion and not stigma.
So you have a chapter in your book called Mother and Child Reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Given your work working with children over decades and being a mother, tell us what that's about.
Yeah, that's a story about my dear friend who unfortunately died about 5 or 6 years ago, who at the time that she was diagnosed, she had to go into a sanatorium, and her son went to a boarding school. He was about 10 years old. And her husband was also infected, so he was there in the sanatorium with her, and their son was far away in a boarding school. They didn't get to see him very much. And that was a very, very hard thing for her as a mother that I certainly could totally empathize with and understand. Not only that, but in my case with my husband, since I myself was not infected, we would have been separated by this policy as well. And so that just brought home to me, you know, how difficult these decisions are and how much they impact, you know, the very personal lives of individuals and families in a very deep way.
So we're talking with Elena Schwalski about her new book, Waking in Havana, A Memoir of AIDS and Healing in Cuba. And I'm wondering, Elena, as you've written this book and had this really amazing journey, and you've dealt with so many emotions, and the epidemic has changed over time. And I'm wondering, how do you see that change, both as a disease and someone who's really worked within it since its beginning, but also how has that changed you over this period of time?
Yeah. it's funny how sometimes the most difficult experiences of our lives can really teach us so much and bring so much to us. And I feel like I'm a different person for sure. And most of it, I think, is in good ways. I think that, you know, I've walked in the shoes of people struggling with this kind of disease, and AIDS is not the only one. And I've survived, and I've turned my own grief into a beautiful project, which I mentioned briefly, which is this bridging of the gap between Cuba and the U.S. with the AIDS quilt, which has been one of the most nurturing and enriching and one of the things I'm proudest of in my life. And all of that has, you know, just enriched my life so much. And I have a lot of hope now around AIDS. I also taught peer educators in Tanzania a while ago. And so I've had a few different experiences with the epidemic. And, you know, I have a lot of hope that there's a lot of headway being made all over the world. And at the same time, a little bit of worry that people kind of are going to get very complacent and feel like, oh, AIDS is over. We don't have to worry about it anymore. It's just another chronic disease, which is not true in most of the developing world at all, where resources are scarce to do prevention and to do treatment. So it's a mix of hope and worry, I guess, that I feel right now. I think that education is still the key and very, very important, and personal testimony. And I think that inspired me to write the book, was this sense that personal testimony, how powerful personal testimony can be when facing issues like this.
Well, we are really thrilled that you did write this book. It's one that I would encourage our listeners to take a look at, to read, to contemplate. The humility, the passion, the compassion that you bring to a disease and a country and a people. This crosses all countries, all people. And I want to thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you very much for inviting me. This has been a great conversation.
We've been talking with nurse, activist, Elena Schwalski about her new book, Waking in Havana, A Memoir of AIDS and Healing in Cuba. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. Listeners can send us any comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, it's yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura.
My daughter and I are having a little disagreement, and I would like your thoughts. I want to get a dog, but my daughter says it will be risky since I'm 80 years old. She has a friend whose parent fell and broke a hip while walking their dog. But I've heard that a dog is actually good for my health. What do you think?
Oh, I love being right in the middle of these conversations, right, Laura, between a parent and a child. You know what I usually say?
What do you say?
I say they're both right. No.
They're both right.
They're both right. Well, that's...
I don't want to be the type of...
I don't want to be the type of... Well, anything's got risk, right? And certainly, I mean, I have seen many injuries from pets. But on the other hand, I've seen so much benefit from my patients on pets. I mean, other than a grandchild, patients want to show me pictures of their dogs and cats, you know, more often than anything, and their eyes light up. And it just, you know, and I think it's helpful to share some data. There was a recent article in the journal Circulation. It's the Journal of the American Heart Association. And it actually looked at some major studies on pet ownership. And it showed that, you know, compared to those who didn't have a dog, those who were dog owners had lower risk of death for heart attacks. You know, those who were living alone had lower risk for heart attacks and lower risk of death for strokes. And this couldn't be explained only because of, you know, like just, you know, maybe it was physical activity or decreased depression and loneliness. But, you know, these were observations. These are important ones. So it improves quality of life frequently, and it may increase longevity of life. It, you know, these are important considerations. I would use data here. I don't know what you think.
Oh, I have three cats at home, so I'm a very pro having pets type person. I think that the benefits are sort of almost immeasurable sometimes, what they can bring to the table.
The cats aren't probably increasing the physical activity, are they, for the...
Oh, no. In fact, they do the opposite, because if I have a cat on my lap, I'm less likely to move anywhere. I'm going to stay right there.
Yeah. I think this was dog ownership. I suspect that cat ownership has similar benefits. Probably. We might have to, you know...
Yeah, we'll get that checked out.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if it includes other animals, you know, with rabbits or snakes, but...
Maybe a particularly chatty parrot.
Oh, a chatty parrot. Yeah. Yes. Certainly, I would encourage you to have a serious conversation. You know, you can do things to improve safety. You can help the parent understand the type of dog and leash and those kinds of things to avoid
right.
the kinds of things that might be more likely to have them fall, to let go of the leash rather than trying to hold it if they get pulled and things like that. Thank you for the question. What's our very next house call?
I recently started a medication for my asthma called Advair. And I noticed that when I take it in the morning, I'm fine, but I happen to get dizzy when I take it in the afternoon. Is this common?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say that it is common, but the reality is anytime you have a new medication and you have a side effect, it has you worried that they could be, you know, true and related. Matter of fact, I think it's more likely to be related than not related. You know, Advair is one of these types of medications that's a combination medication with a steroid. So it reduces inflammation in the lungs. It's good for things like asthma and obstructive pulmonary disease, along with something that helps dilate the lungs, a bronchodilator to dilate the lung lining. And the question really is, what sort of side effects could that be occurring? And typically the anti-inflammatory aspect of the medicine would not have those type of side effects. But the bronchodilator, the thing that's dilating up the lung, certainly could, because one of the things it does is it can raise the heart rate. And so I would say you really need to talk with your doctor. You really need to bring this to the attention of your doctor because, you know, some people who take these medicines, they might have reasons why if it increases heart rate, even only 5 beats, you know, a minute, that may be enough for some people to cause them some side effects. In terms of dizziness, you know, it's less likely. I haven't seen that as much, but I think that it's certainly possible. And if you stop it, which would be the thing you might need to do, but you need to talk to your doctor and it goes away, then you know that it is related to that. And so maybe you're trying a different medicine, a lower dose. These are things you should try.
Nice.
Yeah. What's our very next house call?
I was talking with my husband the other day about my father. My dad has chronic kidney problems, cirrhosis, depression, and Alzheimer's. While he still eats and walks, I've heard of palliative care and was wondering if this is an option for my dad and what that means. How does it differ from hospice care?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and we've
in the answer too. Yeah,
yeah, and we've had some specialists on our show on palliative care in the past. I think we've had people on hospice care, but then, you know, sometimes it can be really kind of confusing because a lot of times you'll hear, like if you're in the hospital, they may say, you know, we'd like to get a palliative care consult. And I think a lot of people think, oh, they're talking about my loved one's dying. But palliative care is, I think, not just about people dying. It's just the fact that people are declining. In this particular patient, there are three or four chronic conditions, mm-hmm. any of which could be fatal under the right circumstances or the wrong circumstances here. You know, the kidneys really could quit working, and whether or not they're going to go on dialysis or not, their, you know, either their blood pressure or their heart may be significantly affected, particularly with the age. And then, of course, the dementia is in and of itself ultimately usually a progressive disease. But what the palliative care can do is it can help elicit what your preferences are. What would have been the preferences of your loved one? What would they want done? How would they want done? How to think about it. So I just had recently a patient for which we got a palliative care consult. And what they brought me back in was their healthcare power of attorney, their overall power of attorney, their information around their preferences for end of life care. And we were able to have these all these conversations about how to protect the dignity in those choices while they're still actually well enough to have all of those choices be real. And I think that was way before hospice care, which we generally think of as in the last 6 months of life. Mm-hmm. So they both can help and provide this comfort. But palliative care can be kind of right now while we're also doing treatment. Once we go to hospice care, a lot of times we're not doing any treatment.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. It sounds like there's, in some cases, there could be some overlap, but they're also, they serve two distinct functions.
Yeah, I was talking with a patient caregiver recently. I said, you know, if we move into hospice care, you'll get more support probably than you will in palliative care. But if your loved one gets sick, you may not actually treat her. So, you know, are you prepared to say if she gets pneumonia, we may not use antibiotics or some other things? We could, but become they tend to make that shift. Some of the caregivers make that shift. Oh, we're not treating anymore. Mm-hmm. It's not absolute. There is overlap. You really need to clarify what your expectations are. But palliative care can be useful many more times than it's actually done.
Great.
What's our very last house call?
I've worked in the same job as a senior manager at a healthcare company for a decade, and I've never missed a day. Recently, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure and asthma. I've also struggled with anxiety and depression that are unclear if they're related to medical problems or stresses in life. Regardless, it's hard for me to work. My doctor said I should take a month off, but I'm worried this will impact my job. What do you think?
Well, I think this is one of the things that you certainly should talk if there is a HR, if there's a, you know, someone who works in kind of helping you understand what your benefits are from that perspective.
Right.
You know, you should certainly do that. You can talk with a social worker. We should understand that the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act of 1993, was to require employers to provide employees with job protected and unpaid leave for qualified family and medical, you know, emergencies. This could be a medical emergency. So your doctor's already thinking, you know, you really need time off to figure out how you work through these mental and physical health challenges. And it's determined that you probably need a month off, meaning they're worried about it. And they're worried that if you stay in the work environment, those things may get worse and you could end up having to maybe even get hospitalized. So I think, you know, those are important things. Some of the people familiar with the laws will let you know whether or not you qualify because you have to be with the company for 12 months. The employer may have to have 50 or more employees, you know, what you may or may not get paid, keeping your job open so that it doesn't, you know, affect those things. And then, you know, what's considered a family and medical emergency? Certainly, if your doctor's writing you a note that it's a family or medical emergency, that's a pretty good sign that it probably will be a family or medical emergency. Great question and an important issue, and I really hope that you get the help that you need. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can share any questions or stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Elena Schwalski. We'll hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill. 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.